Hey, folks, we got a special sponsor for today's show, and there is a one-day sale. SunsetLakeSabade.com and The Majority Report are teaming up to turn this election day into a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. Reproductive rights are human rights, as you know, and we're putting our money where our mouth is. Here's how it works. You visit SunsetLakeSabade.com today. All day, starting actually really almost 12 hours ago, and you got 12 hours to go. All Sebade products are going to be 30% off with the code ELECTION through tonight, midnight. 10% of all the proceeds from election sales will be donated to Planned Parenthood, and the Majority Report is going to match those 10% of those sales. So get on it right now. Great time to pick up any of the products. I was just talking about my experience last night with eating two gummies of that all spectrum with the TSA in there, and it was a little more than I had anticipated. But nevertheless, I've got some tincture with me today. I've got some Sibide gummies with me today, just in case it's a rough day.
Mm-hmm.
SunsetLakeSabade.com is a majority employee-owned business. They pay a minimum wage of $20 an hour. This past year, Sunset Lake Sabade donated more than $26,000 to anti-drug war organizations, animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, refugee resettlement organizations. They have great farming practices. They have great business practices, and they're a movement partner. Again, today only. Head there right now, SunsetLakeSabade.com, 30% off with the coupon code ELECTION, 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 SunsetLake.com. Take advantage of this deal. Help raise some money for Planned Parenthood. They're going to need it. Some restrictions do apply. And now for the show.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, November 8th, Election Day, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, while we are hopefully going out and voting, starting to look towards the election results in this country, take a moment to cover the Israeli elections from last week with Amjad Iraqi, editor at 972 Magazine. Also on the program today, go vote. If you did vote, make some calls. Listen to the show and make some calls. Get your family to vote. Get your friends to vote. Republicans are favored in the House. Senate, it looks like a toss-up. And Donald Trump all but announces his 2024 campaign bid, held back at the last minute. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court is hearing a case that could devastate citizens' ability to force government to uphold the law. We spoke to Professor Timothy Jost, I guess, a month and a half ago or so about this Talvesky case. We'll have more on that in the coming days. Texas early voting trails its numbers from 2018. Don't know what that means. Figured I should tell you. Fetterman campaign is countersuing over Pennsylvania early ballots to make sure that they're counted, despite their not having a date, but also despite the fact that election officials clearly know it was here before today because they had them.
What time travel?
All right, fair enough. Well, then they could really be sent back, and then they would be redated. DOJ dispatches monitors, election day monitors, to 64 jurisdictions around the country. Florida blocks them. Ron DeSanctimonious. Federal judge suspends New York State's gun restrictions because that judge was appointed by Trump. And Zelensky opens the door to negotiations with Russia, as per our mentioning yesterday. The U.S. Quietly asked the Ukrainians to do so to shore up support from their allies in anticipation of some hard times coming this this winter because of the war. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm a little loosey-goosey in intro today. Didn't I come across?
Yeah, well, we've got Emma other things
Vigeland
on our
here.
Minds.
She's
yeah.
voted as per her...
There we go.
I vote absentee because
I don't
sure
know
what that came from.
I don't know. Well, I'm in the spirit of loosey goosiness here.
Oh, all right.
I voted early, but I waited to put the stickers on until today, just so I could do it for the show, like a prop.
Oh, that's pretty good, actually. That was thoughtful of you, folks. You know, again, there's really, generically speaking, no reason not to go out and vote, and hopefully. I think people understand the importance of this. Somebody wanted me to sort of prioritize what I think is most important. It was one of the IMs there, but it happened very... Oh, here it is. Please rank these activities by priority level for the lame duck Congress, assuming Republicans take over the House at a minimum. Judicial appointments. Well, the judicial appointments, if... Well, I guess you're presuming that they would lose the Senate. Yes, I would put judicial appointments... Although there's only so many, the Electoral Count Act 80 of 1887 reform, yes, and repealing or infinitely raising the debt ceiling. I would go with the debt ceiling. I mean, judicial appointments is in the Senate. I don't know. That's a hard. I think raising the debt ceiling short term. Is super important because you will inhibit their ability to, although the electoral, I need more time to think about that.
It's a good question.
It is a good question. And I guess maybe we'll have some time over the next couple of days to think about it. Hopefully we won't have to worry about the judicial picks because the Senate, hopefully Democrats will retain. Who knows? Hope springs eternal in terms of these House seats, but it is hard to look at the data we have. And I know John from San Antonio would say, you know, it is the if you look at the generic ballot, and the generic ballot looks more or less tied right now, as far as I can tell. So hard to say what's going to go, but we will have a decent sense of it this evening, not a conclusive one. Pennsylvania probably is not going to be counted for a couple of days. Georgia may end up going to a runoff.
Mm-hmm.
We may end up resolving nothing of the key questions other than maybe the Democrats have lost the House.
Although maybe we'll have a better sense of what's happening in Ohio.
Well,
that could be, right?
I mean, we will see. But tonight, joining us on our coverage, Alex Perrine will be here. Dave Weigel will call in. Daniel Nakanian will call in. Heather Parton will call in. Ben Dixon will call in. And I think my sister is going to be bringing little meatballs.
Oh, very nice.
No, that's not for the audience. And John Benjamin may stop by. Not sure. We'll see.
Star-studded.
Yeah, really star-studded. Tune in for that if you can. Two big races. Maybe the two, you know, biggest one, we just mentioned them, but just by chance, Pennsylvania and Georgia. Here's what, here's Fox News on their final pitch for Dr. Oz last night on Tucker Carlson. And I'm not being facetious. Republican candidates have shown up on Fox, like, incredibly outpacing MSNBC, just because I know people like to make those parallel comparisons. I mean, in a way that is, there's just like, this has always been the Republican communications department, essentially. And to the extent that it has not been at different times, it's just because that there were personal disagreements with Trump. But here is Tucker Carlson, Republican spokesperson for the Republican Party at the moment, with, yes, a doctor.
A medical doctor who feels comfortable making these assessments on air.
Yes, like Brill Freist back in the day when mm-hmm. he was telling us about majority leader in the Senate. And actually diagnosing a woman who is in a vegetative state in the state of Florida. Because that direct, that's called telehealth. Here we go.
And Fetterman himself has said that his stroke was due to a blood clot from the heart. That is very significant, Tucker, because a study out of a journal called Stroke, very prominent journal looking at over 6,000 people from Great Britain, have found that if your blood clot comes from the heart, you have about less than more than a 60% chance of either not living 5 years or having another stroke within those 5 years. It's greater than 60% chance. So I say to the voters of Pennsylvania tonight who are ready to check a box tomorrow, I think before you check a box, you should consider a statistic like that. Greater than 60% chance that someone like Fetterman, with a heart in his condition, having had a stroke, will either have a recurrence or won't survive the term. Tucker?
I really hate to hear that.
Yeah. Barely concealing his, like, so devil-toothed good. Grin.
Have not looked into that, that study. And or the doctor's claims to know the state, the particular health of Fetterman. But let's be honest, half the Senate, I'd be surprised if they're going to make it through this term.
Feinstein can't remember what she had for breakfast this morning. And Chuck Grassley is currently on the ballot for another 6-year term at 89, tweeting out like different, you know, typos about pigeons in his yard. And there have been two senators sitting, you haven't heard about it, but this calendar year, who have had strokes. You just haven't heard about it because it's not in, you know, Tucker Carlson or Dr. Mark Siegel's advantage to highlight that.
Chuck Grassley going to be 95 at the end of his next term? I mean, look, My great uncle would go to rock concerts at age 94. But that was basically it for the week. It wasn't like he was going like, you know, four nights a week. It was like I went to a rock concert and then I rested for the rest of the week.
Why doesn't 538 have a whole actuarial like mm-hmm. section where it's like this is like the rates of this person's going to die. So like maybe because it's not the most important thing.
And maybe because some of those people would be a little bit higher up on that list that we mentioned. Than I mean,
what are the statistical chances that either Trump or Biden is going to make it to the end of their term right at this point? But that's what their pitch is at the end. And that has been, you know, I think maybe probably somewhat effective in terms of moving some voters. We'll see in Pennsylvania. I really don't know. We know, you know, you can see it a little bit in the polls, but it's hard to disaggregate what it is. And then of course this is, you know, the idea of Herschel Walker winning in Georgia is one of those things where you sort of feel like, maybe this experiment is over in terms of America. But here's Herschel Walker's closing statements. Once he nailed that pronoun thing, he really went for it.
Mm. And y'all saying that I don't need to run. Yes, I do. Because the grace of God has done so much for me. Now it's time for me to pay back. And as they say, that's not what your country can do for you, but that's what you can do for your country. That's what I'm about right now. That's what I'm about right now. No. Wait a minute. And now they're going after our military too with all this pronouns. And I'm like, pronoun? What the heck is a pronoun? My pronoun is sick and tired of this, because Senator Warnock pronoun is going to be former senator. That's a good pronoun for him, former senator. And then we're going to say, don't let that door hit you in the right side as you leave the people's office. Don't you think that's the best thing to do? And y'all,
I love the idea, like, you know, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Like, you could trans bash for the sake of your country. And you could mock trans people. That's one thing you could do.
What the heck is an adjective? What the heck is a verb?
What's an adverb?
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask if it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
Exactly. That's where we're at, folks. So if you have the opportunity to go out and vote, let's do it. We will have, you know, the recriminations will start tomorrow. But for today, go out there and vote. We're going to take a break in just a moment. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Amjad Iraqi, editor at 972 Magazine. And if you think our the state of our country electorally and just sort of like in terms of ideologically is bad, wait till you hear about the Israeli election results. Talk about a ship that has sailed, but we'll get into that in a bit. You know, one thing that might be missing from your daily routine, hydration. Where do I get mine? Right here, ladies and gentlemen. Well, that's actually a different bottle. It's not branded. But this is where I keep my Liquid IV every day. Because I double it up. Liquid IV fuels your everyday well-being by keeping you hydrated. Just one stick, you get 5 essential vitamins. You're hydrating 2 times faster than water alone. Supposedly we're having cooler weather. Makes it harder for you to tell that you're getting dehydrated, though. Liquid IV, you get 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. It's non-GMO. It's free from gluten. It's free from dairy. It's free from soy. Plus, Liquid IV as a company is on a mission to change the world. They have donated over 25 million servings in 50-plus countries around the world. This stuff is great. I don't know how many years now I've been drinking it on a daily basis. Keeps me hydrated. If I'm going, I'll take extra packets. If I'm going like on a flight, you get dehydrated there. Sometimes if I've had too much to drink the night before, first thing in the morning, I will give myself an extra one of these. Every day I drink it, and the flavors are delicious. This one happens to be watermelon. I have broken my tangerine streak that I was on for like, it felt like months.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing with me. I get into a rut and then forget about it. I was on that matcha. They have like a matcha one that has an energy. I did that for months. Then before that, it was watermelon. Those are basically the three I think I rotate through now. Or and pina colada. They have great taste. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco or get 20% off when you shop Better Hydration at liquidiv.com. Use the promo code MajorityRep at checkout. That's 20% off anything with code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Also, another product that we have used around here. Job numbers still strong, despite the fact the Fed wants to crush the economy. But in the meantime, if you're hiring, you got to try and figure out what type of role you're hiring for. Maybe you need to hire someone who wears many hats, which can be very challenging. That's one of the issues that we have in this show. We have people doing everything here.
I wear a lot of hats, too.
And Matt, on top of that, wears a lot of hats. You might have a simple position to fill, but it's taken a long time to find someone who's a great fit for your company. Doesn't matter if you're looking for a civil engineer in New York, or you're looking for an attorney in Colorado, or a pediatric nurse in Nebraska, a mascot in Missouri, a podcast producer in Brooklyn. ZipRecruiter can help you find qualified candidates fast. And here's the thing. The best time to try out ZipRecruiter, in my opinion, is when you don't need to hire somebody. Check it out. Get comfortable with the situation. Maybe get a sense of what's out there. That way, you're never caught, not fully prepared, if you're suddenly short somebody. You can go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority right now. You can find everything from an accountant to a zoologist, everything in between. They have a matching technology that finds people with the right experience, and then they invite them to apply for your job. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. That was my experience when we hired old Brendan, still young, but old to us. Check it out. You can go for free right now at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MAJORITY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And lastly, we're getting around gift-giving time. I mean, it's almost Thanksgiving. Well, not 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then it's Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and Christmas and just that end of the year gifts. Well, how can you give a gift that keeps on giving? It's easy. Cozy Earth. It is, not only is it the brand that made Oprah's favorite thing 5 years in a row, Cozy Earth bedding is made of the finest premium viscose from highly sustainable bamboo. Their bedding is naturally temperature regulated, so they'll sleep comfy every night all year round. Constant reminder of the gift that you have given. And you can level up your lounging with Cozy Earth's luxurious loungewear collection, including soft and stylish bamboo pajamas, joggers, tees, and more. I'm starting to look at the joggers. I'm starting to think about it. I will keep you updated on that. I know Emma has a duvet. A duvet, and I love the sheets. For me, it's all about temperature control. And they now have their premium plush and waffle bath towels, which sounds pretty good. These are all great gifts for yourself. Every Cozy Earth bedding item comes in a beautiful reusable canvas bag, so there's no gift wrapping required. Check it out. Now's the time. Save 40% now on Cozy Earth. Hurry, holiday offers end soon. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority. Be sure to enter majority at checkout to save 40%. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. All backed by a 100-night sleep guarantee. CozyEarth.com/majority. We will put a link in the podcast and YouTube descriptions and also over at majority.fm. Quick break. When we come back, I'm Jad Iraqi, editor at 972 Magazine. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Amjad Iraqi. He is the editor at 972 Magazine. On the, I guess, the video call from Israel. Is that right? Okay, great. Amjad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So there's really two, I guess, major sides of the story here. One you wrote about today. One is the sort of the election results in terms of like the governing coalition, which by all accounts is the most right wing, the most stable, even I think probably in a long time, of Israeli governments. Those two things are, we'll talk about that in a moment, and then simultaneously, the fracturing of the Arab-Israeli parties and what's happened on that end. Let's start with the sort of the headline stuff. Will you just walk us through essentially what happened? It is, and I think it's also important for people to understand too that I think most people who have watched Israeli politics, this is not. This is not an aberration of some poor. This has been the natural progression of things that has happened, as far as I can tell, for the past 30 or 40 years. We're at the end of a chapter, as it were, or an era.
Yeah, I think all the things you were just speaking about right now are kind of very much point to what's been going on in the country for well over a decade. So for those who are unfamiliar with the Israeli election process, so we operate by a sort of proportional representation. So the idea is like you cross a certain electoral threshold in order to get a seat in the Knesset. And what we have now is about 3.25%. And so Israeli politics and elections are very much this kind of tug of war about trying to accumulate as many people as possible onto your party and onto your bloc. And that tug of war is very much around like who decides to kind of ally with each other in that coalition. Now, when most people, when they kind of look at the Israeli elections of the past several years, you know, they'll think that there's this really, that everything is very much kind of between sort of right-wing bloc and the center-left bloc. But that's actually not really how Israeli politics is divided. The central question that is dividing most of the parties, if not all the parties, is around whether or not they will ally with Benjamin Netanyahu. And that was certainly the case for a large number of years. And then about a year or a year and a half ago, there was a kind of cobbling together of an anti-Netanyahu alliance. But in reality, most of these parties are actually in the sort of right-wing camp. They actually echo a lot of the same politics and policies that the main Likud party led by Netanyahu actually espouse. So in terms of substantive policy, there's not actually that much difference. And they all have a very kind of core consensus, especially when it comes to certain aspects of like how to organize Israeli security, about maintaining the Israeli occupation, especially even economic policies. You don't have that much difference. It's really around the singular individual. And what we've seen today actually is that not only is that camp still dominating the Israeli political spectrum, but that almost like the natural state of things is for Israeli society to go with a right-wing camp that is really well organized by Netanyahu, who now has a 64-seat block as opposed to 56. And you know, part of this tug of war is not just the organizing of this right-wing block, which has been increasingly accumulating in power over the years, but like you said, the very fact that there's this breakup of Israeli Zionist left parties like the Labour Party, like Meretz, that was unable to cross the threshold. And as you're mentioning, the Arab parties, which about 2 years ago or two, 3 years ago, were part of a united slate that were actually the third largest group in the Knesset, and then end up dividing. And that division actually weakened that other side of the tug of war. So there's a lot to unpack, but it really is almost like this kind of return after this almost anomaly of this Bennett-Lapid government that was running things for the past year. It's kind of returned back to the right-wing dominance with Bibi at the helm.
But it's a return there, but it seems to me there are two different sort of like differences, two prominent ones and ones that are going to have a lot of relevance. One is that I don't know how to really express this. The fermentation of the right-wing nature of this government has progressed at an accelerated rate. I mean, I for instance, I remember when Avigdor Lieberman was sort of the outlier. Like, people couldn't believe that this guy was in the government. He had outwardly racist positions and was calling for stuff that people just felt was so draconian. And now this guy is like, you know, a centrist within that party, it feels like. So there is an element of this party that is so, I mean, I don't think you would find a lot of people who would argue with the idea that there is an element within this government now that is coming from, the Jewish Strength Party, I guess they call themselves, is fascistic. I mean, I just don't
and
think
supremacist.
That's like, supremacist, everything that's involved with this. I mean, I think there's supremacy enough to go around across the board, but like full on, I think, just from an academic perspective, fascistic. And that seems to be a difference in terms of like slightly qualitatively. But then the other thing is that there's a stability to this government that Netanyahu has assembled that to me hasn't existed in a really long time. Can you speak about the stability part first?
Definitely. What you were mentioning, for example, about it's called like the Jewish Power Party, which is part of a larger state called Religious Zionism. And they become very much the stars of the show precisely because of their sort of almost unvarnished supremacy and fascism for all intents and purposes. And they really have become the kind of one of the most influential groups in this. And there are kind of two ways to understand this, you know, this trend that A, allows for these increasingly fascistic trends to occur. And like you said, the fact that you now have a much more solidified base on this. So the two levels are, first of all, understanding Netanyahu himself as this kind of gatekeeper that's been around for 12 plus years. And as that gatekeeper, he increasingly opened those gates to increasingly right-wing politicians and parties. So like you said, about a decade ago, Avigdor Lieberman was regarded as, you know, the most far-right politician, calling for the transfer of Palestinian citizens inside Israel, along with other policies. And then a few years later, you get someone like Naftali Bennett, who was the previous prime minister now of the Yamina Party or Habayit Yehudi Party in previous incarnations. And he was regarded as even further right than Lieberman. And then somehow over the past year, he became sort of almost like centrist. And then you end up getting characters like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is the head of the Jewish Power faction within Religious Zionism, and Smotrich, who heads that particular slate, who are even considered further right. And so Bibi was actually the one who very much allowed this to occur as the person who kept legitimizing gradually, slowly. And now you're getting to this point where someone like Itamar Ben-Gvir is actually regarded as a very legitimate participant in the Israeli political spectrum. So you're very much right on this.
And Ben-Gvir, I know a lot of the people, you know, watching and listening to the show are younger than I, but Ben-Gvir is a Kahanist, and Meir Kahan was a right-wing rabbi, ultra-Orthodox, who was shunned. I think it was in the 80s or the 90s, and this guy was in Knesset because they're, you know, very tight voting block. Basically, I mean, we have some of that in New York State to some degree, but I mean, and he was shunned at that time. This guy Gavir has something like 50 citations or indictments for basically terrorist acts in Israel against Palestinians. He was celebratory around the assassination of Rabin at the time and making threats about Rabin in the lead up to his assassination, which, you know, really, I think in many respects, to the extent that there was any attempts to sort of like bridge a gap with the Palestinians, and make peace, Rabin was probably the last vestige of that inclination. And he was assassinated by a a member of one of these ultra-Orthodox Jewish sects in Israel. And just to give a sense that that guy has now been named, has the portfolio for the internal police, essentially, a department, which is, I mean, it's nuts. I mean, I don't even know. I'm trying to think of like what would be the analogy in this country, and I don't think there is one.
And the historical context on Kahana exactly tells us what's been happening. This kind of leads to the second level, like, you know, how is it that the Israeli political spectrum responded so differently to Kahana back in the 80s, where they, you know, made him as an outcast, even forbade him from running in the Knesset, and there became like designated as a terrorist organization, and so on and so forth, and then exactly how he got here. And there are many potential answers, but one clear one is, at least one that I would want to highlight, is the understanding, the increasing understanding among Israeli society and the political spectrum, that you don't have to hide the inherent supremacism that exists in Israeli political ideology. So, you know, that ideology is Zionism, which obviously has many, many spectrums from kind of left to the right. But at its core is this demand and this insistence on Jewish privilege, if not Jewish racial domination in the historical land of Palestine here. And back in the 80s, the political spectrum kind of said, like, we're pursuing this goal in many respects, both inside Israel and the occupied territories, but we're kind of playing by a certain decor. We're kind of playing by certain rules, and we're not going to have this kind of outright, very explicit way of expressing this. And this was a constant debate between the right and left for years. And what's been happening over the past two decades especially is that Israeli society has grown more and more right-wing, in part because they're learning that they can actually get away with it. So there's a reason why that people are becoming more and more explicit about their supremacism, that they're becoming more and more explicit about this demand to institute apartheid as apartheid. And now that there are even calls by Israeli politicians to actually forcibly expel Palestinian citizens, to forcibly transfer even Palestinian occupied territories, because especially for the past 10, 20 years, they're realizing that no matter what they do, no one's actually really going to hold them to account. So why would you need to play polite? Why do you need to kind of go by this sort of decor in order to kind of fulfill what you need? And this is why you have people like Itamar Ben-Gvir and the Jewish Power Party being able to say, like, let's do away with all these, you know, with all these dances. Let's actually just be straight out. And as we're seeing from the results, that's actually something that really resonates. And even if you don't go as far as Ben-Gvir, keep in mind that groups like Likud, even Yesh Atid, even the National Unity Party, which are kind of regarded as more center-right, still espouse many of the end goals of those policies and still demand this insistence about Jewish superiority and Jewish supremacy in some form or another.
And it resonates because, and we should just reiterate this for any audience that is not, you know, based in Israel or doesn't follow this, because the Palestinians who are being occupied don't have the ability to participate in the democratic process. And so that's why the split of the joint list is so, I think, important to understand. And the role of Mansour Abbas, right, who essentially split up the joint list and sided with the center right or right wing faction in Israel. Can you talk about the dissolution of that and what it meant for Palestinian representation more broadly in Israel?
Certainly. So within Israel's sort of state borders or within its citizenry, about 20% are Palestinians who were obviously here before 1948 when the state was established. But since 1948, they've had citizenship and the right to vote, etc. Now, over the decades, this right to vote was still kind of, you know, curbed and influenced different ways. And even though we have that citizenship, we're by no means equal. There are numerous laws and policies that have been in place for decades, some of which are even being implemented in the occupied territories, which operated against us. Now, where that has taken us to today is that in the past two, three decades, you started having more kind of identifiable Arab political parties. And you have four main ones at the moment. One is sort of like a more kind of traditionally kind of communist socialist party. One is kind of regarded as like a liberal party. One is an Islamist party, and the other is a nationalist. And up until about 2015, they kind of ran separately, would get between maybe 2 and 4 seats. Now, Avigdor Lieberman was actually one of the ones who pushed to raise the threshold from 2 to 3.25%, which was deliberately designed to kind of weed out these Arab parties if possible. And the response by the Arab parties was to actually join a common slate. You know, there were a lot of pros and cons to this, but what ended up happening was that they created this joint list, which accumulated 13 seats, and at one point, not too long ago, also acquired 15 seats as the third largest kind of grouping or party in the Knesset. Now, the experience of the list is quite telling because in many ways, it kind of established itself as the only truly pro-equality anti-occupation camp in Israel. And the irony is that that camp in the Jewish state was led by Palestinians. They were the ones who were demanding kind of unconditional equality for everybody in the state, demanding an unconditional end to the occupation, which was very different from the Zionist left. And so they really established themselves as a very different kind of force. And in the past few election cycles, they even kind of took their step a bit further by recommending Benny Gantz, who's a former army chief, who then entered politics, and they decided to kind of back him as a potential candidate to oust Netanyahu. Now, Benny Gantz himself is a center-right figure and obviously a very militaristic figure who kind of boasted about bombing Gaza back to the Stone Age. But for the joint list, there was a very strategic game to this. It's that if we can sort of force out Netanyahu as this far-right gatekeeper, and try to at least put some leverage on Gantz to create a center-left bloc, then we can kind of have more influence over the government to provide for Palestinian citizens' needs and also address the Palestinian question. Gantz basically dismissed all of that. He couldn't take the idea of being with that kind of political camp. He couldn't take the idea of allying with an Arab party. And the fact that the joint list had almost nothing else to offer after that allowed the Islamist party, Ra'am, led by Mansour Abbas, to say, you know what, I'm going to take this a step further. I'm not going to hold myself just to a center-left grouping. And since it's been a part of the Lapid-Bennett coalition, it's actually had a very peculiar kind of experience because it didn't really have a ministry. And ironically enough, it wanted to kind of reduce its Palestinianness in the sense they wanted to focus on the socioeconomic concerns of Palestinian citizens. But what they discovered was that every time there was a major issue that related to Palestinians in the occupied territories, especially, Ra'am could not go with the coalition. So they were actually one of the main reasons why it fell apart. There was a law to ban family unification, Palestinian family unification. Ra'am could not get behind it. There was another law that was about like applying Israeli law to settlements, which is a very standard law, but needs to be renewed, and Ra'am could not bring itself to renew it. When there was escalations on Jerusalem and the Temple Mount earlier in April, I think, Ra'am, you know, also as an Islamist party, said we cannot allow the government to get, you know, to do this on in the sanctity of those areas. And so despite its best efforts, it was constantly pulled back by that Palestinian base and by that Palestinian identity because it couldn't sign on to those kind of policies. But in the end, and that fissure is very much evident now, whereby because Palestinian citizens are caught between understanding that the right wing, that the Israeli spectrum is increasingly right wing, but there's also no Palestinian national movement to tell them and guide them, where are we going from here? Like, how do we fit into this larger question between the river and the sea? And so this is where you end up having this division with now Ra'am having 5 seats, the communist liberal slate having also 5 seats, and the more nationalist one was not able to get to the threshold.
Amjad, was it your sense that that last coalition government was in many ways purposefully trying to cleave, you know, like the Arab Palestinian partner in that coalition, trying to cleave it off on some level by repeatedly, you know, pushing those things? Or is it just simply that is where the Israeli public and the Israeli body politic is?
Definitely. The idea of divide and conquer strategies has been a very huge constant in terms of the Israeli state's relationship with Palestinian citizens and, of course, Palestinians writ large. And when Mansour Abbas was kind of breaking into this kind of this position to say that I'm actually open to any to any potential alliance in the government, Netanyahu himself started kind of giving words, also entertaining the ideas like, oh, yeah, maybe that this could actually be something. Like, he was actually stoking these divisions, say, like, actually, you might have an opportunity to be part of the to be part of the political system. There's also a period where Likud was also making a big push for Arab voters inside Israel as well. So this divide and conquer was always very much there. And also, this goes also to the more Zionist centers and the Zionist left, because they weren't really ever pleased with the idea that the Arab political parties are united. For one, they're basically taking away Arab votes, which they would otherwise try to take. But the other was that, as I was mentioning, the joint list set itself apart as, or let's say it kind of became the core challenger of Zionist parties trying to claim that they were the real democratic and liberal camp. Because when push came to shove, there was always some conditions and always some things that they had to curb to curb democracy, or to say that actually we maybe need the occupation right now. If not, say, like, actually we want to keep the system as it is right now. So the joint list always put these Zionist parties in a very uncomfortable situation. And so, the different treatments of these Arab parties, it was almost in the hope that they would kind of begin to break apart, and we're seeing the results quite evident. And it's not just obviously that those divide and conquer strategies, but obviously within the community as well, there are huge debates and discussions and diversity of opinions. But that, but the experience, again, as I said, of like how the joint list tried to act and was then dismissed, and how Mansour Abbas even tried to be a part of it and was essentially kind of put aside, or could not bring himself to really be part of that system, is something that's still being debated in the community.
And just an update on, to the extent that there is a left that still exists from an electoral standpoint in Israel, like Labor is down almost like about as small of a presence within the Knesset as you can get and still be there now, right?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, the Zionist sort of left and center left, as we traditionally define it, has been moving rightwards for quite a number of years. So the positions that it might have held even in the 90s is nowhere near what they're espousing a decade ago or today, certainly. And what you're seeing today is that the parties that traditionally define themselves as generally center left, you now have the Labor Party, which has come down to 4 seats. That's the minimum. And Meretz, which was also kind of, it's much more left than Labor, but they weren't even able to cross the threshold. And there are a whole host of explanations for this. And again, this is part of that splintering that allowed, that broke the center left bloc, or the anti-Netanyahu bloc, in order to allow the right wing to get, to pull further in that tug of war. But that complete erasure of a real center-left idea, center-left camp, is very evident. And it's been evident for many years, and it's even clearer now. Most Israelis identify as right-wing. Most Israelis are voting for right-wing party. Most Israelis, even if you're kind of more secular and more liberal, are actually much more in the center-right sort of camp, like Yesh Atid, led by Yair Lapid. And so we can't think of this as a sort of left and right anymore, almost. It is a battle within an Israeli right, which is the dominant force and the dominant idea of how Israel should be. And the battles are within that right-wing camp with these very tiny kind of Israeli leftists and, of course, the Arab political parties. That is the situation we're in today.
Do you have stepping back a little bit, I'm sympathetic to the argument that there was a certain inevitability if you're going to found a country on an ideology like Zionism. I am sympathetic to the argument that there was a certain inevitability. But putting that aside for the moment, from your perspective, what has happened there? Look, we've had in this country, there has always been a significant portion of the country that is, conservative. In this country, largely that is anchored by the evangelical right, and then a broad coalition with capitalist interests, and that has defined the conservative ideology in this country and the right wing nature of it. And also, I'm sympathetic to the argument that we have, two sort of like center rightish parties or whatever. But put that aside. But in Israel, it feels to me, having been my whole life essentially been in some way or another been following Israel, that over the course of the past 30 years, There has been a real change in the demographics of the country, and B, commensurate with that, a drift to the right, and in some instances like a full out sprint to the right. From your perspective, if you accept that premise, what have been the factors that have contributed to it, outside of a notion that there was a certain inevitability with that the ideology would lead there?
I mean, there's definitely, it's not a question of inevitability, but it's definitely a question of, you know, what are the trends that have operated both in Israeli society and politics and also internationally? So, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and struggle like has been what, you know, it's been intricately linked to how the international community, you know, how it operates, especially the United States. What was U.S. policy in Israel-Palestine? And that always interlinks and has an impact, and vice versa, obviously, in how politics and society works here. Now, you know, in terms of the rightward shift, I think, you know, it was always happening in some respects since the Likud party kind of broke into the Israeli spectrum or the Israeli government in 1977 by winning those elections. But the second intifada of the early 2000s, I think, really transformed Israeli society from this period where they thought that, at least in their minds, you know, that there's a kind of peace process and maybe we'll give this Palestinian state, even though it was quite skewed in that respect. But the second intifada and the violence that unfolded, you know, but not in terms of the Israeli experience of Palestinian violence and, of course, you know, Israeli state violence upon Palestinians. But this idea that, you know what, we're not going to buy the international community's ideas of these kind of peace parameters, and we don't trust the Palestinians, you know, anymore. And so we are kind of going back to this kind of self-reliance and might is right. And you know what? We're just going to push these boundaries until someone stops us. And the international community, you know, which has always been very much, you know, tilted towards the Israeli side on this. You know, this is not a conflict of equal parties. This is a vastly asymmetric conflict, and always tilted to the Israeli side. And then sort of went along by saying, "What? Well, yeah, you know what? We don't want to kind of pressure the Israelis because we're worried that they're going to shift towards the right." So they actually started going more carrots rather than sticks. And they thought that that would actually encourage the Israelis to go back to a peace process and to kind of shift back to center-left bloc. But the exact opposite was actually proven to be the case. The more the international community stepped back and did not kind of hold Israel to account, did not actually challenge the Israelis when they were continually growing settlements, when they were slowly de facto annexing, when under the 12 years of Netanyahu, whereby there was a lot of friction with international governments, including the U.S., you know, Barack Obama had infamous kind of standoffs with Bibi on this front, and still could not bring themselves to take basic policy actions that they would with anyone else, like with annexation vis-a-vis Russia, or any kind of anti-democratic policies by a so-called like friend and ally like Israel. And so the more they step back, the more the Israelis realize, oh yeah, we're getting away with this. What, you know, we can keep pushing the boundaries. It's a very natural kind of socio-political response. And so like when you're used to impunity, why would you change course? They're actually saying that my method and the method that the right wing had basically infused into Israeli society was actually proven correct, that we can keep going about this because everything else is basically falling onto our side. So it's a lot of complex factors, definitely, but I think these interplays are really, really crucial. And it's not an issue. And again, Israel is not unique in this respect. Right. You see a lot of these kind of same trends across many countries. It's not exceptional at all. But what is being a little bit exceptional is the extent to which that impunity is so encouraged, especially in the United States, and that there's no kind of even thinking to try to think about a different kind of way of politics and policy to understand that Israel is going down a very far right, if not fascistic, trend, and obviously instituting a regime of apartheid and, you know, kind of and being very unapologetic about it. And that drastically needs to shift.
For me, what stands out is that in terms of that dynamic and the role that the U.S. played, that during the Bush administration in particular, that dynamic changed. No longer was the U.S. a reason for an Israeli politician to look to their right and go like, you know, we they're holding us back, the U.S. It seemed like the Bush administration was like, not just I'm not letting you have the keys because you're a little bit drunk, but rather I just put the keys in the ignition for you. Get in the car and you're good to go. Like, I mean, that they forced the hand. It seemed to me, like they did the opposite. They not only like gave, you know, like just like carrots, like they were force feeding carrots almost on some level, to use your example. And then the other thing I wonder is, over the course of that same period of time, particularly from like the early 90s into the early aughts, or maybe late into the late aughts, you have an influx of almost 2 million Russian emigres who are brought in. They are in many instances used as facts on the ground to populate the West Bank by the Israeli government, to in addition to sort of an influx of ultra-Orthodox coming from the United States to some extent. And, but this is a country of 5 million people at that time, 4 million people. And over the course of the next 20 years, 2 million people who have essentially grown up under what was an authoritarian regime enter into the country. And I feel like that also exacerbated, you know, there's other trends there, but to the extent as an accelerant, that also exacerbates it, because a lot of times they're put in a position of like, here's your land, maybe unaware of like, it wasn't really your land, but once they get it, they're convinced it is. What's your sense of that?
So on the first kind of point about the Bush administration, you're definitely right. And there was, during those early 2000s, it was this big confluence of, first of all, you had Bush in the White House, but also Ariel Sharon as Israeli prime minister, who himself was a very right-wing, yep, very militaristic figure. And so there was this kind of partnership that ultimately emerged.
And it was his, we should remember, like, it was his, obviously you know this, but it was his marching on the Temple Mount, or basically on the what is considered one of the most holy mosques for Muslims, marching across there with a bunch of soldiers that in many ways set off. I mean, there was obviously other factors, but it was one of the catalysts for the Intifada.
Yeah, exactly. And that built up both in terms of the Second Intifada, and also, of course, that was the time of 9/11. That was the time of the War on Terror. And so you end up getting this, this alignment of these narratives and these wars, both on the Israeli side and the American side, and being able to kind of piece it together. And so those early 2000s, you had the Americans tell the Israelis, go for it. And obviously the Bush administration itself, intervened, massively in the Middle East with the Iraq war, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there was this massive macro structure that allowed for, the two states to kind of to really go all out. Now, in the later years, I think the Bush administration tried to kind of begin to rectify that a little bit. They also tried to make a few peace pushes. They were still kind of on the two-state agenda. But again, the inherent lopsidedness of who they're allying with, to really just keep giving the Israelis a carte blanche and actually putting more of the burdens on the Palestinians as the weaker party. And all this, of course, is in relation also to the fact that the Palestinian leadership during those early 2000s was also ripped apart. They also were kind of reeling from state violence and the violence that they had also carried out, and they were actually much weaker. And so there was also no Palestinian leadership to also really significantly play a role in that, especially after Arafat's death. So it is always this kind of constant confluence that emerges, and we're dealing with that impact today. Those defining years in 2000s really set the trend for Netanyahu to come to power in 2009 and to keep pushing those boundaries ever since. Again, the question of Russian emigres, I mean, demographics, they obviously have a huge role in the kind of political, cultural influences that they bring. I wouldn't say that they had necessarily like a unique role per se, though there's definitely a kind of direct correlation in the sense of like Avigdor Lieberman's party, Yisrael Beitenu, which was actually kind of regarded for a long time as the party for most Russian Israelis, which kind of focused a lot on their needs. And, most Russian citizens here, like, or Russian Israelis kind of, didn't always necessarily care as much about Lieberman's Palestinian kind of policy in that respect. But, it's sort of like you take what you get from these different kinds of parties. But like you said, there are also those who went to the settlements and said, yep, cheap housing, occupation, not occupation. There's also arguments about the idea of like how the kind of the idea of strength in politics kind of infused a bit more into Israeliness, though that's also been very much the case within the state before the massive Russian migration. So I definitely think it played, I would imagine it played a role. But yeah, I think there was just like these larger macro factors that were at play that's just allowed it all to kind of reach the point we're at today.
Can you talk and expand on, and I know you've spoken about this earlier in our conversation, but the rise and like not actual fall but return of the Sith Benjamin Netanyahu, I'm conflating two Star Wars titles there, but whatever, the fact that, you know, basically he had these corruption investigations into him, he was trying to cling to power for a long time and he was ousted. But now he's back, and it always kind of seemed inevitable that he was going to come back into power, at least from the outside. But I guess what the domestic response has been in Israel to that Benjamin Netanyahu reprieve, and if some of the kind of shame of the corruption investigations and everything that that involved has kind of faded away, and if there's like a genuine yearning for him to return to power.
I mean, the cold fact is that Netanyahu's corruption charges and the trial was never, insofar as Israeli public was concerned, it wasn't really a major political issue. On the contrary, a lot of people, even if they thought that, you know, the corruption charges were quite bad and, you know, unbecoming, but the idea that that Netanyahu was still like the best politician for the job. And even if they didn't like him, they still respected him and still thought that he was kind of, you know, managing government in a good and efficient way. And so insofar as most citizens are concerned, it's not really a crucial issue. Where it is a crucial issue is in the right wing's agenda. One of their core kind of targets actually right now is the Israeli judiciary. The Israeli right, as I think there's also kind of a lot of right-wing forces in different countries, they keep talking about the Supreme Court as this kind of like this bastion of leftist ideas, and that they're kind of obstructing, more kind of, quote-unquote, like democratic means, democratic being like right-wing ideas, and that they're keep holding the state back. This is actually not the case. If you can literally take the data to show that the courts, the Supreme Court especially, often just aligns with whatever the government ever wants to do at any given time.
I mean, let alone, sorry to interrupt you, but like what has been in the news recently where they consistently side with Israelis who are displacing Palestinians in their homes and just taking them and saying, well, if you're a Palestinian, you didn't have a permit for this, so we're siding with the Israelis. Like from the outside, at least, it seems pretty clear how that shakes out.
Exactly. They are really a reliable rubber stamp when it comes to Israel's policies in the occupied territories. And to be honest, also vis-a-vis Palestinian citizens. There are a lot of laws that were passed under Netanyahu's reign, which Palestinian citizens took to the Supreme Court, and the court said, no, we can keep the laws. And they would come up with all these bizarre arguments in order to keep them in play, and sometimes even supported the racism of those laws. But the right wing still kind of wants to play this out. You know, they have it on some levels because of the Smith that the court is kind of obstructing them. But for Netanyahu, it's a very specific reason that the more that he can infuse political influence over the courts and the judges, that he's hoping that he can then it can play a role in ensuring that he doesn't get charged by the courts. It's ensuring that they kind of espouse his right wing beliefs and his right wing values. So that's a kind of the weird dissonance, and sort of like that the public is not really that riled up by the question of corruption, but that it is very much in the forefront of the minds of people like Netanyahu and the far right for other reasons.
Amjad, we're going to be obviously talking more about where Israel goes from here, because obviously the implications of this election are not just a reflection on where the Israeli public is at this point, but it's also, I think, like the actual material differences that are going to start to roll out of a a government that is both this far right wing and so stable, seemingly anyways, at this point, that that is a recipe for some, I think, some really horrible legislation and things moving forward. And we're going to have to deal with that on another time. But as far as today, thank you so much, Ahmad Iraqi, the editor at 972 Magazine. We'll put a link to 972 Magazine. We read it quite a bit around here. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you both for having me, really.
All right, folks. Boy. I mean, you know, it's not hard to sort of contemplate what's happening in this country in terms of a rightward drift. I mean, we have a lot more sort of, I think, like, we are a far more diverse country. So I think trends are a lot slower in this country in many respects. And because of the sort of like the geographic dispersion and the nature of our government, in some ways, you know, the population can move in two different directions, and they're, you know, for now anyways. But if you look at like what's happened in Israel over the past 20 years, and you look at like different places in Europe, and you look at like with frankly, you know, where Russia is going and the common cause they're beginning to make with some of the sort of Christian fundamentalists in this country, you know, you start to see some like broad trends that are not terribly encouraging. So we're probably going to be drinking a lot tonight.
Yeah. Tune in, folks.
Yeah, tune in. Should be really, really disturbing. It's quite possible it's going to be really disturbing, like 15, 20 years. I mean, I've been saving this for a while, but, you know, I don't know, this week in particular. Oosh. And, of course, you know, you'll notice that each time what they do is they go right for the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why the center left, through the left, can't quite understand, you know, like really, really genuinely appreciate this. You know, to the extent that this show has been dedicated to anything over the course of the past 10 years, it has been attempting to sort of make people understand the importance of the federal judiciary. But you hear it there in Israel as well. And it really just about anywhere. When you're talking about fascists, the more often than not, maybe always, they attempt to put what they're doing within the context of a legal framework. And there are two different ways in which you can do that. One is you can pass legislation that says this is legal. Yeah, it was illegal before, but it's legal now. And the other way you could do that is also control the judiciary so that the statutes, what they actually mean, changes.
Yeah, well, it cuts off when regular people's also recourse against the government when it's violating their rights, particularly
the judiciary is a check. Well, almost in every country, theoretically, the judiciary is a check against unbridled, you know, government power. Or and if you control the judiciary, that it's gone.
It's what we talked about. I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, but the difference between the right is ideologically unified and the left is just a bunch of interest groups. And how do you deliver judges for just a different set of interest groups? And we know which interest groups are going to be particularly like wealthier ones are going to be the ones delivered for.
It's just like it's so stark in Israel in particular, especially when you're reading about the different settlements that are happening right now in the West Bank. Like some of these Palestinian people have had these homes for generations, and then Israeli settlers come in. They say, no, this is my home. There's no other way to fight it except to go through the Israeli court system. They go through the Israeli court system, and every time the Israeli court said, well, you didn't have a permit for your home, so now it's either in a military zone or it's under review, and essentially forcing them out in the latter case. And that's all legal, but that's just because only one side is controlling every mechanism of power. And as we see in this interview, they're beginning to control not just like an overwhelming majority of the power mechanisms of power, but every mechanism of power. And it's not getting better. It's just getting worse.
And again, you know, that's why I think the judges are so important in this country. I mean, we just had a federal judge, temporarily roll back any of New York State's gun restrictions. We're just going to see this. We're going to see this in terms of, you know, this case that's in front of the Supreme Court today, in terms of basically a citizen's ability to ensure that laws are being carried out faithfully by particular states, federal laws that are, you know, that the states may try and avoid executing. We're going to see it in turn. I mean, it's just going to be a cascade of a diminishment of rights of people in this country. We've just seen the rollback of an individual right that has existed for 50 years. And the scary part is, it could very well have a mitigating influence on what the outcome is tonight. If we're lucky, it'll have a determinative influence on the outcome tonight. But sort of like getting to that end of the list of what it's going to take, right? Like, I get it. You know, people don't like Joe Biden. He's old. He is old. He walks around there and you do have a feeling of like, is he going to make it through this speech? The Democrats delivered about, you know, a third, quarter of what their agenda originally was. I get it. Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema is at fault. There was also, I think, some strategic and tactical errors made. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's also like the Republicans just took away an individual right of 50% of the population, which doesn't, you know, also, frankly, I mean, it has implications for the entire population. But it's and in doing so, in many respects, basically said, not really. I mean, you're like a full class citizen, but not really. You know, put you around like, I don't know, 19th, 20th. Let's put it that way. You just lost a 20th of your citizenship. Or maybe like, I don't know, a third, a quarter, somewhere around there. And they're just going to keep going. And I don't know what sends the, you know, sounds the alarm bells more. I mean, that's why we're seeing like in blue states, the reason why the Republicans are playing in blue states is because, you know, folks haven't like gotten the memo that this could be a federal ban in a couple of years. And I don't know that Democrats did a great job of pushing that concept. I'm not sure how you would necessarily, but
they lied to you then, they'll lie to you now.
Lindsey Graham introduced the
I know,
thing.
Right. They
I mean so and but all right.
But also, can I just say one thing on elections? Like, Labor supports Democrats. It's easy. Vote for the Democrats. Like, of course, all the, like, the abortion stuff, I hope that turns stuff out. But, like, I don't understand this whole, like, contrarian brand of, like, or, like, their right-wing thing acting like we need to, like, have Fetterman's, like, up-to-date health info. Labor supports him. So vote for that guy.
The only labor that doesn't support Democrats are like communists. Are communists. Yeah. That's the only ones.
Keep it moving. Like, vote for the people who labor support.
It is really not that complicated.
It should be. I mean, we should have like labor have a more independent and forceful voice in that coalition, and it's a problem that it doesn't. But and like until like they start splitting between Democrats and Republicans, it should be obvious who you should turn
out for. Green Party for that matter. Right. Like, I mean, it's just that is. A vote is not an individual expression of your heart. It's not an expression of like your artistry. You can go
what
to
you
a
think
paint,
about that individual
go
candidate.
To a painting class. It's not a litmus test for yourself. That's actually narcissistic to put that at the front of your mind. It's a strategic choice, and you vote with. It's like not that hard, as Matt said. Vote with labor. and then get back to activism and pushing the Democrats later.
Okay, we're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, our coverage tonight is going to start, you know, I don't know, about maybe 5 of 7, maybe 7, maybe 10 of 7. We're going to be loosey-goosey with it. And but certainly, when you tune in at 7, we'll be on.
Mm-hmm.
Or 7:02. We'll be on.
7:05, definitely.
And we'll be here for an extended period tonight. You'll be able to watch some of us eat some pizza. And we will announce what drinks we're drinking at different times.
Oh, yeah. What am I going to drink tonight? We should do a poll.
You'll hear Matt on his, he's going to bring in his 6-foot bong. And
it's only about 18 inches.
And
that's not what that sounds like.
I used to be able to.
It sounds like you're choking. Yeah. There we go.
That's it. We're gonna be smoking out of Sam's liquid IV jar.
Bongs. Yeah. When I was gravity. Rich, they made the bongs out of brass. That was they hadn't come up with the techno. I'm joking.
You got to smoke out of apples.
Brass bong.
You got to smoke out of an apple.
I've smoked out of an apple before. Yeah, I have.
Yeah, what's the best apple to smoke out of?
Right. It really doesn't matter. They're all good.
A snapdragon.
You know, bong is a Thai word. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
I learned that. I traveled around Thailand after college, and I learned that on a trek when a dude just came, was like, chopping away at a bamboo thing, and came up to me, and I'm like, "What are you doing?" He just goes, "Bong," and then I'm like, "Oh, okay,
all right,
there we go."
Message received.
Yes, I guess I speak Thai. All right, just a reminder: it's your support that can make this show possible, folks. When you become a member of the Majority Report, you not only help this show survive and thrive, you also get the free half, free of commercials. And you get the fun half. And again, for those folks who are going through any type of financial stress, send us an email, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the subject line, membership, and we will help you out. That's one of the things that our membership does, is it helps us help other people out. Nobody's going to be locked out because of finances. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. And I think I mentioned this yesterday. They're doing this thing where you can get, you can put on your own photo on their package of coffee. And so I'm pretty sure you need to, check it out. But if you use the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off, and you can order, personalized coffee. And I think you get to choose, what coffee blend you want, which of course is the Majority Report blend. That is that's everybody's favorite coffee.
Mm.
Emma, what's happening on, ESVN?
On ESPN, we talked a little bit about the Astros winning the World Series, as well as a pretty big deep dive, I know, into the NFC North. There are some new kings in town, right? Justin Fields looking really good, plus the Minnesota Vikings are 7-1 still somehow, and Aaron Rodgers can't stop looking worse every game, which is shocking. So check that out, but I'm excited for our OT on Thursday, where I want to do a deep dive into what's happening in the NHL with the Mitchell Miller situation, who was a player who got drafted despite abusing a mentally disabled black kid, and teams keep trying to sign him in the NHL. So we'll be talking a bit about that, plus Kyrie Irving, and also giving our picks for the NFL slate. Bradley somehow pushed twice out of the 3 bets that we have going on, but I now have one more win, finally, this week than Bradley. But Bradley still has not lost in 3 weeks, which is unbelievable. But anyway, youtube.com/ESPN show.
Matt!
For Left Reckoning patrons, we released a discussion with Bronwyn Mehta about COP 27 in Egypt and the human rights issues surrounding that climate conference. That was released for everybody on YouTube, and it will be up on the regular podcast feed tonight. We'll be doing Left Reckoning tomorrow. Emma Vigeland will be joining David and I talk about the primaries. Whoa.
Sorry, the midterms.
What I know, you said 20, 30 minutes, but I guarantee you we're going to be going
longer.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
That is, whoa. All right. All right, folks. That is quite a crossover episode.
Oh, yeah.
Folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. Listen, if you have been out to the polls, we want to take your phone call. Other than that, for right now, please. So if you've been out to the polls and you have something that, or, you know, that is pertinent to that, I was just at, I was in, I voted in Waukesha County and the lines were really huge, or one of those jobbies, call up 646-257-3920. I'll be right back after this.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
What, who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a, whoa, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on, fuck them, fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.